Well, it's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio today Gordon Oyer, who has spent a lot of time in the Champaign-Urbana area of Illinois. Now lives in Louisville, Kentucky, and he has come here to Alaska, and that's what we're going to talk about. Why would someone leave Kentucky and come to Palmer, Alaska, or the Anchorage area? What brought you here?
Yeah, well, I'm visiting a friend. Friend of mine, Kathleen Tarr.
Right.
We met this summer, actually, in a conference in St. Bonaventure, New York.
Oh, okay.
There was a conference of the International Thomas Merton Society that we both attended. And then a week after that, we were also at a conference and on a panel together, also focused on Thomas Merton. And so that's when I got to know her. And she invited me to come visit her in Alaska, and that's what I'm doing right now.
We were familiar with Kathleen's work. She has done some writing that involves Thomas Merton. I know that. And then since you were at that conference, you too must have some interest in Thomas Merton.
Yes, I do. I've been a fan of his spiritual writings for a while, but especially of his writings on social criticism, social critique. And in 2014, I published a book that focused predominantly on Thomas Merton as well.
Oh, okay. Thomas Merton has had a large impact, it's safe to say, on many people's lives over many years, since he passed away approximately...
1968.
Right, which brings us up to about the 50th anniversary of his death, as I remember.
Yep.
And I remember that he had done some traveling.
Yep.
He had been in Thailand, or that Southeast Asia.
Yeah, Bangkok is where he died. And as an accidental death, he was accidentally electrocuted. He was at a monastic conference and came out of a shower and grabbed a pole of a fan with bad wiring and was electrocuted. Sort of a freak death. But you know, before, of course, he went on that Asian journey, he also spent several days in the great state of Alaska.
That's right. We have the connection. And that is, in fact, I believe why Kathleen has an interest in him.
Yep. She has a forthcoming memoir, should be out in a month or so, that incorporates a lot about Thomas Merton and a lot about his travels here in Alaska when he visited, and also in 1968.
So... You mentioned you had an interest in his writings. Mm-hmm. Could you elaborate a little bit more? What about those writings particularly intrigued you so that mm-hmm. you've spent the time?
Well, my first exposure to him came a little bit more a personal background. Most of my life I was raised in and continue to identify as a member of the Mennonite Church,
right,
which is what's called Historic Peace Church, along with the Quakers and the Church of the Brethren. And they've always been focused on the principles of nonviolence, believing that that's core to what Christ taught. And so in my own studies of my own background and my own theology, which focused on peace writings, I ran across writings by Thomas Merton, who was also one of the earlier writers to really focus on the principle, Catholic writers, I'm sorry, to focus on the principles of nonviolence. And
right.
So that intersection is really what introduced me to Merton. And then that got me involved in his other writings of social critique. He wrote a lot on race, and he wrote about terms of war and violence. He wrote against nuclear proliferation, nuclear armament, and he wrote strongly against the Vietnam War, topics like that. And he, again, sort of related a little bit to maybe of Alaskan interest, especially late in his life. He engaged some anthropological works and did writings about indigenous peoples as well.
I'm thinking about 1968 mm-hmm. In light of a recent completion of a series by Ken Burns about Vietnam. I have been privileged to see parts of that. Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to the entire series. But just a reminder, thinking back, that 50 years ago, Vietnam era. That was a time when the war was still going on. Lots of very powerful things happening in this country as well as in Vietnam. So Merton was in Bangkok at that time, which was not the site of a great deal of fighting, although there were certainly American forces present in Thailand as well as of course in Vietnam, Laos, mm-hmm. and the rest of it.
Well, one of the ironies too was that he wrote against the Vietnam War, but when he after he was accidentally electrocuted, his body was transported home on an Air Force or on a plane that was also transporting the bodies of dead American soldiers.
The irony, certainly that it's tempting to ask you to the question, could you summarize what has obviously been a long period of study, reading, introspection, thinking about all of Merton's work, but extracting from all the time you've spent, what is your takeaway today as compared to maybe this, put it this way. So you started this, you were attracted, you began looking more deeply at his work. Years have passed. How has that affected you?
One of the core teachings or writings of Merton has to do with the integrity of the human person. And he made a distinction between individual and in a sense of the fragmented individualism, where each person is sort of viewed as an autonomous individual floating around independent of everything else, and the human person, which has a deep integrity, and from his perspective, the person is someone who knows who they are because of their connection with God, as opposed to having an identity that is self-constructed out of their own ego and out of what other people in society are trying to tell them who they should be.
Okay.
And so that, to me, that's a very important distinction between that I appreciate from Merton, is the distinction between the person and the individual, and that our purpose in life is to try not only develop our own sense of personhood in that regard, but also to look for that sense of person in each other, and to connect with each other as persons and to respect that, not in a competitive individualistic sense, but in a connecting common ground of existence kind of perspective. So that's pretty key, I think, for me, to appreciate him.
So from the much less extensive reading and understanding of Merton's work, I'm also tempted to ask, okay, today mm-hmm. in the world we live in, there seems to be change that many observers suggest, or perhaps an illumination upon aspects of the way people relate to one another that is surprisingly, I want to say ugly at times. It's as if a veil or two has been lifted, and what we're looking at is, people say, what you really think or feel or act, and whatever has been a cover, whether we call it a kind of political cover or et cetera, or just be nice facade, but underneath there seems to be burbling something else. If that is in any way accurate, as I've tried to describe that circumstance, what does Merton have to say to us today in those circumstances?
Well, as a model, I think he was someone who saw one of his missions. He was a monk, of course, so he was in a monastery in the hills of Kentucky. But he was a prolific writer and a prolific correspondent. And one of the things that he felt was his role as a contemplative and as a writer was to bridge differences. And he saw, so, you know, he would write about, and he would try to reconcile that in himself. And so he would try to, it was sort of his goal in almost a mystical sense. So he would try to, you know, understand and identify things that seem to be very opposite. And he would try to bring both of those into him and find a way to resolve some of those differences within himself. And he felt by doing that and being present to both at the same time that he could bring about healing of some of those things that are percolating underneath, that are below the surface, that are not superficial, but that are that there are deeper connections that we can reach despite the appearance of difference. And he talked about, you know, these are, of course, historical in the 60s, but he talked about, you know, bridging differences between Eastern religions and Christianity.
Right.
That was a really big theme of his. And in the late 1950s, some of his novices were Latin Americans, and he sort of got introduced to Latin American issues in the presence of an impact of North American companies and presence in Latin America through them. And he talked about being a bridge between the two Americas, to sort of unite the two Americas. And yeah, the thing, the topic that I studied as well, he brought together Protestants and Catholics, which seems like nothing now, but at the time there was a fairly rigid and large divide between in the minds of, especially popular minds of Catholics and Protestants, about being a big difference. So that, you know. So he brought them together to discuss, in that particular case, what he called the spiritual roots of protest. They all were committed to nonviolence, but they came at it from different religious traditions. So I think that, again, as a model, and his wide correspondence with a wide variety of people, and he had an uncanny ability to, when he met someone, as I said earlier, connect with what he felt was the person, what made that individual person within them, connect with that and speak to them almost as an equal, trying to interact with them on their terms. So that kind of bridge building and connection, I think, is something that he modeled for in a way that we can build on and benefit from by looking at that today.
So that leads us to, of course, the interesting question of, since 1968, have there been others who might follow in that tradition or evolve that tradition to deal with the same issues which remain today?
Oh, that's a very good question. He was influential for what's been called the Catholic left. So he was influential with the Berrigan brothers and people who stood in that tradition. He didn't always agree with their, all of their tactics necessarily, but he was a very good friend to them, and they looked to him as a mentor. So I, you know, the whole idea of faith-based dissent, particularly internal dissent in terms of some of the dilemmas that are going on in our society, where there are the kinds of differences that you were alluding to earlier. So individuals, I struggle, I guess, to come up with, sure, with particular individuals that I think are actually playing that same kind of role. There are certainly writers that are attempting to, I mean, you know, again, from that generation, more or less, or close to that generation, you know, I mean, a guy like Parker Palmer, who's a Quaker writer, comes to mind. And there are writers in the, you know, Eastern tradition as well that are trying to bridge gaps in that way too.
So I think in part I'm hearing that Thomas Merton, in part because of the times, the context of the 60s, mm-hmm, earlier, affected or found a large, relatively large group of people that were receptive to what he was saying in that, mm-hmm, moment. And I'm almost thinking that that's, we hear it said the timing is everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his appearance and writing in those times is part of it. It's hard to separate very often a person from the context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing I should add, too, that he was crucial for is he was one of the earlier writers to try to popularize the discipline of contemplation.
Okay.
And that is, you know, among religious spiritual circles today, that's widespread. That's a discipline that's widespread. But in his day, it was more or less the domain of monasticism in the Western tradition.
Right.
And through his work and as well as his connection with Eastern traditions, he did a great, he played a huge role in popularizing that. And that is certainly something that today, and as a way to focus and as a way to quiet the distractions that are bombarding us, that pull us in those directions, I think that we can give him credit for that as well, to a large degree.
And of course, with the introduction of devices that allow us to multiply our distractive nature, it's a different world. It's a different situation. Contemplation mm-hmm. Seems to it, people suggest, be a much rarer mm-hmm. Part of life. Yeah.
More difficult to...
Yeah, to do that because...
Maybe more difficult, but more necessary because of that.
Well, Mike Malevsky here, and I've been talking with Gordon Oyer. And I know that you have written at least one book.
Just one, yes.
Of just one? Okay. Mm-hmm. One is good. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about how you came about writing that book and what it is.
Well, it ties into a little bit of what I explained earlier in terms of what drew me to Merton to begin with, and that's the intersection of Merton's social peace critique with my own focus that I've faith focus of Mennonite theology. And so what happened was at one reading a biography of Merton, I read about a particular event that Merton had hosted in 1964, where he brought diverse people together to talk about, again, the spiritual roots of protest. And I read that there was a Mennonite theologian there, which piqued my interest. And so that sort of led me, with no real intent to write a book, but that led me to sort of explore in more depth that event to learn what they talked about, what the intersections were, what the differences were. And through encouragement of the director of the Merton Center in Louisville, Kentucky, where some of the records were held, through that encouragement, it expanded over time into a book.
Okay. And the title of the book?
It's called Pursuing the Spiritual Roots of Protest. Thomas Merton named the discussion, the retreat, it was a three-day retreat, but he named it The Spiritual Roots of Protest. And so I named the book Pursuing the Spiritual Roots of Protest.
So it would be easy now to jump to a manifestation of protest, which has memed itself into taking a knee.
Ah. Mm-hmm.
And an individual beginning, which has spread a bit and resulted in fairly considerable discussion about protest, whether you can or can't, or whether there's a particular methodology, or any comment about that, I have to ask.
Well, sure, I'll be glad to share my personal thoughts, I guess, on that. One, in relation to what these folks were talking about in 64,
I mean, right.
One important distinction to make is that there were 14 people there, but they were 14 white men, and they were talking about protest. And in that context, which I'm actually very impressed by the material that especially that Merton provided, and that he focused in 1964 on the concept of privilege and the need to recognize one's privilege, and that for people of privilege to protest, it is really an expression of solidarity with people who are without privilege. And so, you know, fast forwarding, I find it a little hard when I hear white folks critiquing vehemently and negatively the expression of people of color who are trying to speak on their own behalf, in a way like that. And so, to me, there's a difference between if you are in a position of privilege in protesting and if you are not, if you are the one that is, does not have the privilege and seeking your own rights as opposed to expressing solidarity with others. I think there's a distinction. And for me personally, I think it's important to give space for people who are feeling and who definitely, there's no question historically, have been without privilege, and for them to express themselves and to let them do that and to listen to that and try to understand that. To me, as you read various analyses of this event, you know, taking a knee in most instances is a sign of humility,
right,
and respect,
right.
And the Kaepernick and those who started it did not turn their backs. They did not raise their fist. They did not leave. They simply were present, but to express the fact that they felt that what was being expressed had not yet lived up to its potential in this country. They were taking a knee to say it's incomplete. You know, I respect what this is about, but it's not there yet. And we're taking a knee to show the fact that we don't feel, I mean, that's my interpretation of it.
Sure.
And I think that that's a very legitimate thing, respectful thing that should be respected. It has nothing to do with disrespecting military. It has nothing to do with disrespecting the country. It has to do with not yet reaching the potential, to me personally. Long-winded way of giving my personal...
I thank you for sharing that, because this probably has a little bit life, maybe a lot of life left in it as a focal point for discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And some would say, I think that that's an important outcome, that the discussion about protest or mm-hmm. the discussion about the underlying reasons why individuals will either with others or by themselves do this, and what they think about it and all the rest of it is part of mm-hmm. of an important thing that sometimes doesn't happen when we have these feelings that go unspoken about, I suppose. Well, we have a minute or two left. Gordon, I have enjoyed this quite a bit. Any last comments before we finish up?
Well, just thank you very much for the privilege of chatting with you here in this venue. I really appreciate. I wasn't expecting to come to Alaska to do this, but I appreciate this chance very much. It's been great. Great. I didn't come in the summer, come in the fall, but this is breathtaking to drive around and look at the landscape here. It's a little bit different than the central Illinois landscape, flat central Illinois landscape I grew up in.
Yes, I think you're right. Okay. Well, have a good day, and we hope you come back again and enjoy the rest of your stay in Alaska.
Thank you.